My name is Chris Main, MEIN, and I'm with Major General G.J.J. Edwards, DFC, CD. The date today is 17 August 1979, and we're at General Edwards' home in Saanich. We'll call it just Saanich this time. That's all
inclusive. All right, all right.
On the other side of the tape, we got as far as the end of the war and a couple of esoteric arguments that mean nothing to anyone else but us. I'm trying to think now, at the end of the war, we have a reevaluation, I guess, of the Air Force and its role, and you would be involved because there would be the demobilization of those that wanted out, those that wanted to stay, and all that sort of thing. I'm wondering what you were doing and what happened to you in particular.
I can't remember when we were asked to apply for post-war commissions.
You had to make an actual application?
You had to make an actual application. Those in the RCF that had been what we call
permanent,
then PF, permanent force, of course, would carry on in the service. I'm not aware of anyone who asked out. There probably were a few, but not. I don't know of any.
So your commission was only as good as, or was strictly for war when you signed up?
Strictly for war. It was Special Reserve, SR. Isn't that what it was called? We all had J numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, J.
Special Reserve, I think it was.
Athlone signature, of course.
And I was, what was I, J14045?
Mm-hmm.
Damn. How many numbers have I had now?
No, but then they
three or four,
I think. Was too long to remember. The J one was the easiest one for me.
I never did know what the J stood for. Do you know? Was it out of the Joint Air Training Plan? I don't think so.
I have no idea.
I don't know. But anyway, J had a significance. I applied in, it must have been about the time in Halifax when they were calling for applications. And I didn't, that would be in July, August, 45. And of course, I didn't know if I was to have a post-war career until the end of my staff college tour in Toronto, which would put it down into perhaps May, June of 1946.
So now you were sent to staff college.
Yes, well, after that, we discussed on the other side of the tape, Chris, you'll recall, the rough preparations for the Tiger Force, VJ Day canceling all that, the sixth group nucleus that had formed in Halifax to form the Pacific headquarters for the RCF contribution was disbanded. Eastern Air Command, of course, continued, but my job ended there. And lo and behold,
the squadrons were disbanded at this point too. Is that not correct?
Yeah, they were. They were. I'm a little vague on that because suddenly I was out of that game entirely. And without any administrative experience whatsoever, I see here on the 18th of September 1945, I was posted across to RCF Station Dartmouth to be the senior administrative officer. And I think at that point in time, I may have written two or three letters. At most, I had a vague idea of station organization, responsibility.
Yeah, but you were at headquarters in Sixth Group in London and saw things.
Not headquarters Sixth Group in Yorkshire.
I had
a general idea, but I was in no position, really. I had no training, really, to go across to be the senior administrative officer, SRO, they call it, of Dartmouth. But that was my post, and I was there for 6 months. I don't know how much damage I did. It was in March, I see here, 8th of March 1946, that tour was completed and sent to RCF Staff College. Now this was a very encouraging sign to an applicant for a commission.
Ask one thing. Did you notice anyone who they could not make the transition from wartime to peacetime? Your wartime, say, flyers and personnel who then one switched to peacetime, just could not make that transition.
Well, all of us had difficulty. My wife, Ethel, has joined us here, and she will recall right through, I don't know how long you would say, five years, we were still...
75, trying to get the war fever out of their system. And there were so many of their co-fairs around, and they still had to go to the mess and TGIFing. Well, that's all right, they're still doing that. But you know, there you are with little children, and the dinner is ready, and where is Daddy? Oh, you know, you know, it took them a while to get it out of their system. Some of them maybe never did.
Well, I'm thinking of the exceptional case, like, what was it, Screwball?
Burling?
Burling.
Burling. Burling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, going on to the RCF Staff College, we had three or four there that really continued to live in the past and found it very difficult to think constructively about a peacetime Air Force and career. By now, you see, the RCF was down. I'm now in 1946, and we knew that the force was down to some. My numbers are rough. Certainly under 20,000.
By 48, you'd be down to 14,000, or actual strength was 12,000.
12,000, 75% of Plan E. Plan E was, I remember this now, in the job subsequent to Staff College, Director of Organization Establishments. We were writing establishments and setting up an organization for a force of so-called 20% Plan E. Plan E was 16,000, all ranks. Not including civilians.
Fourth largest air force in the world.
Down to a force of 16,000, and then in before 1948, we were down to, I think it was 12,200. Now that is shrinkage of the first order.
Well, according to my figures of 48, you have 12,291 folks.
That would be approximately it. To return to the 5-6 months at Staff College, we were the second post-World War II course. It was still a short course. The Air Force was trying to get through.
No, this isn't tri-service, it's just strictly Air Force.
This is strictly Air Force with a sprinkling of sailors and soldiers included as students. And I do recall there was a soldier and a sailor on the directing staff. But the reason for the short course that continued, I think, for at least one more course, was to get through the staff college for some kind of staff training as many as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at staff college, almost on a daily basis during the last couple of months, that the lists of those accepted for permanent commission began to trickle out at ones and twos a day. Mine took a long time. I've forgotten the day on which I learned I'd been accepted, but it would be probably about June of 1946. So I'd applied, say, in July or August or September of 45. It was the better part of a year before I knew for certain.
At the staff college itself, was there any difficulty in that? Could there be describing a raid? I had heard from others, put it this way, I heard from others that were at a staff college, they would be discussing a particular battle.
Who were they?
The professor or the teacher would be discussing a particular battle, and the students, they would stand up and say, now you know damn well it wasn't like that, because they were there.
Yeah.
And this type of argument, now did you have that same thing at staff college, or was it just strictly staff work and no time for...
Yeah, we weren't concentrating then on particular campaigns. Ours was general staff work, how to write an appreciation, how to write a letter, how to summarize a situation, how to understand more about things like logistics.
So it's not really the war college, it
was staff training, very much staff training. In fact, that activity, much later on, became what we call the junior staff course. Teaching kids who were good pilots or good engineers or good medics for that matter, more about the Air Force structure as a whole and straight staff duties, how to become a staff officer.
Now, you'd be, you and your colleagues are, I guess, would be packing a lot of rank at that time, too.
I attended as a wing commander. We had group captains on course, and a large number of squadinators, perhaps one or two flight lieutenants. But the average rank there would be wing commander at that time.
Yes, you successfully complete your course the summer of 1946. When does reversion day come for you?
Do you recall from earlier interrogation the actual date? I was still a wing commander on the 19th of July. No, 19th of August. But it seems to me that 1 September 1946 was reversion date. Does that ring a bell with you?
I'm thinking New Year's for some reason.
No, it was earlier than that.
You called around September.
Yeah, September 1946, and I had gone to I had come off course still as a wing commander, and I had been told that was it. When they offered you a commission, they also offered you a rank.
Mm-hmm.
And my wartime rank, senior rank, was a wing commander, and lo and behold, I was offered squadron leader. Far beyond my expectations. I fully expected
lieutenant?
Flying officer or flight lieutenant.
Would you have gone as low as flying officer?
Probably. At that point in time, I was convinced that an RCF career was for me. No,
so you would have accepted as low as flying officer.
You're asking me to hack back a long time. I
didn't have to make the decision.
That's right. There was no decision, really.
I think in General Lane decided, well, like, I think he was a group captain when he was reverted, and he was saying, well, maybe...
Squadron leader?
Squadron leader. You know, he didn't want to give too much up, and then they offered a wing commander, and he just said he'd jump out of his feet.
That's right. That's right.
Very similar in yours.
That's right. There was another group captain on course, and I think he was offered squadron leader, and I think he said thanks very much and didn't. Most of the wing commanders were either flight lieutenant or squadron leader, and it seems to me that the majority got squadron leader because you were a fairly hand rubbed group at that point to have been selected for staff college. Some seer saw the potential, so called, and a number were dropped. A number were not offered permanent commissions. In part, we talked about this earlier, their inability to adjust, and generally their performance at the staff college.
So it was a question of you did well at staff college.
If you made an answer to the staff college, you weren't offered it. I think we had a course of perhaps about 25, and it seems to me that 5 or 6 were not offered. The decision there was delayed through 4 or 5 months of the course, and their performance, I gather, was such that their potential was considered not sufficient, and they were not offered permanent.
So you were looking at a very cream of the crop lot, I guess.
Well, you were looking at a lot of nervous airmen too. I can tell you, your track record certainly mattered. Particularly,
what else can you do, eh?
That's right. That's right.
Well, everyone's got a DOC. What else can you do?
That's right.
Oh God. Well, you come out of this. You come out as a squadron leader.
First posting, then. First real serious so-called peacetime posting to Air Force headquarters in Ottawa and the Directorate of Organization and Establishments.
Well, at this time, if I'm not mistaken, around December 1946, there's the unification of the three services. We'll have one minister of national defense as opposed to a minister for air, sea, and land. one National Defense Headquarters building?
Well,
did it happen that early?
Three, actually, there were three. There were the three connected buildings in Ottawa on Elgin Street.
This is what Brooke Claxton, of course, comes in.
That's right. You recall the dates more accurately than I can.
No, I don't recall them. I have a cheat sheet, that's all.
Yeah.
According to the policy in the report of National Defense, they give the date of December 12, 46, and it's the object of unification include unified defense program to meet the great strategic need, the single defense budget with funds and resources allocated to, you know, in accordance with the program, elimination of duplicatory and even competing services, greater emphasis on defense research, closer coordination, government departments, industry, and just moving the services into a unified as opposed to these three utterly separate.
Yeah. Well, the term unification wasn't bandied about then. Not in the sense that it was described later on, 20 odd years later. The Air Force continued in the building that they had used, Air Force Headquarters, on Lisgar Street. The Navy tended to be in their building on Elgin Street, and the Army in theirs on what we call Cartier Square. They were connected by overhead passes, but as I recall in those days, we were still worlds and worlds apart, although we were under a single Minister of National Defense now. As far as it affected the activity of the individual services, I don't think that political decision, an administrative decision more than anything, really affected us at all. We were devoting all of our time to putting together a very small peacetime Air Force. You quoted the figure, some 12,000. I remember writing, I arrived in DOE, Director of Organization and Establishments, that was charged with writing the structure, the detailed structure, by rank, by trade, blah. I arrived there in August, and I remember we were still working, Saturday mornings then. We were working Monday through Saturday noon. But since our shop was charged with this, and the plan seemed to be changing constantly, we used to spend weekend after weekend rewriting the whole Air Force structure and establishments. And my uncertain recollection here suggests that we rewrote for at least a year until we finally gelled on an establishment that we called, our establishment we called, the nucleus for expansion. We wanted an establishment filled with what we called hard trades and officer professions that would be difficult to pick up off the street quickly in the event of a requirement for a rapid mm-hmm. expansion again. So we tended to hold to a minimum what we call soft trades. And what would be a good example of a soft trade? Well, say a cook. A cook was considered a soft trade. Perhaps the accountant field was considered a soft trade. But trades like aero engine mechanics, airframe mechanics, armament specialists, and in the case of the officer corps, same game. Telecommunication experts. Armament officers, aeronautical engineers, and of course the whole range of aircrew. So we built that first post World War II establishment to the tune of around 12,200 around hard trades. I don't know what the other two services were doing, but we felt that our approach was a very, very sound one. And subsequently, I think we were vindicated in our approach.
Now, how do you sit down and decide that there'll be, you know, four flight lieutenants, you know, eight squadron leaders, 14 flight sergeants, or whatever they...
Well, distinguish of course between a rank structure
Okay,
and activity structure. First of all, you had to decide what you were going to do. And I remember as we shrank over the period down to this 12,200, at one point in time we had two manning depots. We had one on the east and one on the west. Well, one of those manning depots disappeared in the early gyrations because we decided that we could man the force through one depot rather than two. We reduced, for instance, the number of armament depots that we had around the country. So you decided on activity, and then you said, right, for that activity, we need that kind of station or base, and then you structured your base with internal activities, and then finally, having done all of that, you put trades and rank to those individual functional activities. We were very functional in those days. Well, still, Air Force still is, really. But it was a paramount importance that we got the function right, and then we got the activity within the function, and then finally we gave the activity a rank structure.
So the primary, then, if I got it correct, primary reason behind what you were doing is that someone had then decided, say, that Comox, for example, will be a base.
Right.
Or a station. I'm not
sure. A station in those days. They were still calling them stations in those days.
Okay, so if Comox would be a station, it will fulfill this role. And then that directive would then be given to you to figure out what man it would take to fulfill the role given?
Well, it was even more complicated than that. But first of all, you had to decide. Were you going to continue? Were we going to have a small RCF bomber command? Were we going to have
no,
a fighter force?
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is that you weren't deciding those things as a major. You were just manning. Is that not correct?
Well, the recommendations went up and the directives came down, and we would send up the echelons, proposals, structures.
So you had to do the initial planning for this.
We'd sit around and say, what about this? What about this? We talk to the planners and decide what sort of basic plan they were putting forward. And then we would very quickly convert that plan into a manpower establishment cost. And many of the plans were rejected because we knew we were being saddled with a list a little over 12,000, and there was just so much one could sensibly do with 12,000 people. So whereas a plan might come out advocating this, the numbers just didn't fit the plan. So it was give and take between planners and this director of organization and establishment until we finally hammered out.
Is that enough to drive you to drink? Or
we had the odd drink. We had the odd drink in the process of that. But I tell you, they were maddening, but damned exciting days, because you had the sense of forming the post-war RCF. And the activity was right there. And we had scales we applied for given flying hours, et cetera, et cetera. Sort of an organizational technical thing that I won't discuss now, but you never knew when you got a plan and started to apply the activity within the plan, then the number of bases to make that activity work, and then finally work the thing down through manpower scales and rank structure, what your answer was going to be at the end. We were striving for 12,100, and regularly we'd come in with what seemed to be a great plan, and when you finally structured it, you found you were saddled with 14,500 people. Back to the drawing boards. You had to lop off 2,000. How could you do it?
And still maintain
an integrity, a professional integrity.
So you're finding over 2,000 jobs, is what you're saying.
Well,
you say
a lousy 2,000 or 3,000. We knew that we had to bring the game in a given number, but we had to start from the activity end and work down rather than start with the 12,000 and work up. We finally did it. I've forgotten when the plan finally was put to bed. And my guess it would be towards the last quarter of 1947, when we finally had a structure.
What was the RCF doing in the meantime?
Not very much. not very much. Regrouping, if you like. We still had Lancaster sitting around. We still had fighter aircraft around. The old Eastern and Western Air Command aircraft were still about. Squadrons were still flying, but greatly reduced. The budget must have been a horror in those days. I didn't have much to do with that.
Other than $196 million in 47-48, and 48-49, it increased 28% to $251 million.
When a dollar was a dollar, right?
When a dollar was hard. But,
ouch. That's all I can say. What about this new equipment too? Because I mean the RCF, they picked up the Vampire.
Vampire
in
that stage.
As an interim jet to help it with the balance of payment as well as to get some jets. We had other new planes coming in, and It wasn't the Sabre online, was it?
Sabre was much further down.
No, but which was the first jet you were waiting for? You took the Vampire, and then the next one was coming. It slipped my mind.
Yeah, well, there was some talk of meteors in those days, wasn't there? But they never did appear. CF-100 was probably on the drawing boards by then.
Yeah.
The twin all-weather fighter. No, the arrow was another one. That was the CF-105 at that point. But we're way back in 47, 48 still. The only new equipment that I recall appearing was the Vampire. And as you say, it was a directed solution. We were still looking for, when you think on it, we were still looking for a post-World War II role for the RCF. Continental air defense was still very much on the drawing boards. We knew that the Sabre, the American, the first of the Sabres, I think the Americans were in the process of producing by early 1948. We weren't to make a Sabre decision, I think, until something like late 49-50, when we decided to go Sabre and go the American route.
Was there a lot of hassle that way with the British and the trade commissions and the attachés?
Not from where I sat in director of organization establishments. The operational requirement people, another activity altogether in Air Force headquarters, were hassling that one, and it really didn't spill over onto us significantly at all. We were just trying to put together the ragged edges of an enormously reduced force, and to develop, I guess, what we were calling a viable structure in those days. And I'm sure the Army and the Navy were going through some similar activity, but we were working in absolute isolation. I don't ever recall really discussing. In fact, this stuff was terribly classified at the time, because each of us was wondering what the other was doing and how much you were going to get, etc., etc.
Only one pie now.
Only one, allegedly only one pie. I think a little further down the road it turned out to be three pies, really, but at this point in time it was very much in-house. Those days, what did we have? We had an officer corps of, I don't think the officer corps was any more than 3,000, and you knew practically everybody, from the pilot officer through the chief. The chief in those days was Robert Leckie, to be replaced by Wilf Curtis. We didn't see very much of the chiefs. We were down
what about,
there.
What about Powers? Of course, would he be gone?
He was gone then.
But did you see Plaxton and his crew at all?
Yes. Yes, but not. Remember, we were relatively junior staff officers,
yes,
at the squadron leader level, and that sort of interstaff relationship tended to occur probably at no lower than group captain. So we were locked in our own little offices. And many in an office in those days, I remember sitting in an office about 200 feet square with four or five officers, four or five desks. You could hardly move, but all doing interrelated activity.
What was the social life like in Ottawa? Did you get a place to live? Buy a big house or?
Heaven.
You know, when Jerry finally got off staff college, there weren't any houses. We were just lucky. We found one that was wall-to-wall linoleum.
A very old house.
At least it had a refrigerator.
That's right.
We didn't have a refrigerator.
Right.
It was one with
couldn't buy a refrigerator.
Coils on the top. They weren't making them. We were lucky we had a refrigerator, and it had a piano. It was semi-furnished, and every time I dusted the furniture in the dining room, everything was falling out of the chairs, and I thought there's going to be a bird flying out. And we had a coal yard on our left, a livery stable down the street, Walker's Bakery across the way. It wasn't exactly rockless.
It wasn't elegant.
It wasn't elegant, and it was $65 a month. And we discovered, having had two babies there, that we couldn't afford the $65 a month. So we were looking around for something maybe smaller, but something that was cheaper. And then suddenly Jerry was transferred to Washington, and that was saved our lives. We just couldn't afford that $65 a month.
We were still on the wartime rates of pay. We're now up 3 years later, 1948. And it seemed to me that a squadron leader, I was a flying squadron leader. I was still getting flying pay. It seems to me that a squadron leader was making $9.75 a day, which is what, under 300 a month? What is that, about 250, 270, 275?
But remember, Jerry, you bought the Hudson. You bought a car for $2,000.
Bought our first automobile.
It looked
couldn't buy automobiles. Couldn't buy much. And that as late as 1947, 1948.
Yeah.
The commodities were limited. Even if you could afford them, you could you had difficulty buying them. But I do remember in that period, automobiles, by and large, were still under $1,200 a copy. May that happy day return.
Well, the Hudson, and it was sort of secondhand. It was from an Air Force friend, and he happened to have a Studebaker and this Hudson. And the Hudson he had paid, when it was new, $2,000. And it had, I don't know how many miles on, not very many, and sold it to Jerry for $2,000. And that was a lot of money.
An enormous amount.
First time we took it out, somebody backed into it. Remember that? Oh.
Yeah.
What about the social life itself, Air Force?
Well, we were surrounded by my wartime colleagues. Ethel had moved from Montreal to Ottawa. So we had, I don't know, what would you say?
Well, I think you and your friend enjoyed the mess on Gloucester Street.
Well, we all
and
did.
And we only had the one car. I didn't know how to drive. And besides, I was housebound.
You weren't on the cocktail party circuit?
Oh, no.
Hours.
Oh, no, not by well.
Well, yes.
Sort of.
Yes, but...
And the babysitter thing was another thing. Trying to find a babysitter.
Everybody with young families, baby boom too.
All of us, essentially in the same boat. Lots of new babies.
I always felt that George and Janet Newsom had more money than we did, because once in a while we would be invited for dinner and it would be roast lamb, I thought, oh my goodness, they had a much nicer house than we had. Not as big, but nicer.
What was the social life like? Still plenty of partying, still pretty heavy drinking. New families everywhere. We had a We had a fair round of bridge players in those days.
Yes, we did. But there is a social life with our Air Force friends at our rank level.
Yeah.
We weren't going off to elegant receptions or anything like that. It was just seeing your friends.
And I suspect that essentially that's the Ottawa pattern today. You socialize with your friends and your colleagues from the office. But in those days, on very, very short financial rations, there was just so much one could do unless you had a private income, which we did not. And two new children, no Medicare in those days.
No.
Arranged for your own obstetrician, pediatrician arrangement
at
an enormous cost.
My second baby was born in Ottawa, and I chose to have a private room and go to not a general practitioner, go to a specialist, and Jerry indulged me, and in those days they kept you in the hospital for 6 or 7 days before they let you home with your baby. And as Jerry said, there was no insurance at all. You paid the bill, and I think my doctor's bill was $300 for that baby, and the hospital was about $150. And that was a lot of money in those days. But that's one thing I just decided I was going to do in style.
One thing I do remember in those days, we still weren't paying income tax. And I've forgotten when income tax came online.
Well,
probably during that period.
Because you were in the force, or your income wasn't high enough to.
It would have to be because we were in the force, because our income at something like at around $300 a month, yeah, $3,600 a year. I'm sure we were taxable, but we had remained exempt, and then that period of grace ran out. But I can't remember exactly when. But
it was a great shock though when it happened.
Yes.
Still is a great shock.
Maybe that's when we started looking for a less expensive quarter.
That could have been it.
Yeah.
That could have been it. I may have started paying
the
income tax.
Deductions.
Now you would have perks of office, so of rank, so wouldn't you?
No,
it was a flat change, deal on food and goods.
Nothing like that. Nothing like that.
There were no PXs or things like that, or no.
No, you were living on the economy totally. There were no quarters provided or anything like that.
No bitterness about this. No way to treat your. Land fit for heroes and this.
No, I didn't. That sort of thing. Yeah, everyone was in the same boat, and that sort of attitude. I don't think occurred to many of us. We were so wrapped up in Air Force affairs.
I really think that
you don't
recall civilians and just living the way other people lived, there weren't any PXs or commissaries. Anyway, we didn't. We weren't exposed to that until we went to the States.
Hmm.
We didn't have that.
Well, what happens now? You get transferred to Washington. It's a low rank to go to Washington, isn't it?
Well, this was an exchange. This was a sort of a standard rank down there at the time. We had had an exchange program had worked out between the American Army Air Force that became United States Air Force, it seems to me, in 1948, USAF.
Mm-hmm.
And we had had an officer, an RCF officer, in the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
in the organization business. It was the director of organization in the Pentagon for some year and a half, 2 years previous. And the chap who was down there was suddenly recalled, and in March, I was told right out of the blue, I had no expectation of this at all, that we were off to Washington in an exchange post.
In the Hudson.
And our second daughter, Penny, had was born in March. And we, in fact, started down there in early April. And with one brand new daughter and one elderly daughter would be all of what, a year and a half old, perhaps the most. And it was a very exciting development, my first posting, as it were, out of the country as a full-fledged RCF career officer into the Pentagon, about which I had heard but really knew nothing about.
Now, would you live in Alexandria there? Or?
No, we sublet it.
Yes, an American.
American lieutenant colonel was off on course from the office in which I was to be employed, and he let it be known that he wouldn't mind renting it while he and his wife were away. So we lived in that for what, 2-3 months.
Yeah.
And then we.
But it was so far away. It was in Northeast Washington, and the Pentagon, of course, is
Virginia.
The
was across
in
Virginia.
So I took Jerry, and they were nice. When now Jerry is a pilot and not a navigator, but a pilot, and a good sense of direction. Some nights, 7 o'clock, 7:30.
Can't get there from here.
he actually got lost.
Got lost.
Got stuck in the traffic or whatever. So
it's crazy town for traffic.
Well, in those days it was even worse.
Really. All those circles and monuments to dodge. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I used to think, my goodness, he's lost or he's dead.
You'd get lost in the building itself.
Yes, but very, very quickly sorted that out.
What was that story, Jerry, about someone going into the Pentagon? Well, it would be a sergeant. By the time he found his way out, he was a major.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has ramps.
Yes.
But crazy. As far away as we were, this was with in the house of a chap who was in the office. He came back, and we knew he was coming back. We had to find another place, and we found another semi-furnished rental. Not terribly far away, and the reason we did that, two of the lieutenant colonels in that office, American lieutenant colonels, lived in that area, and we were persuaded that good end of town and from which to operate, and indeed we formed a carpool, and the three of us went back and forth at the Pentagon.
Now, what about money and things? Were you given more? Stipend or?
We were given a bit more, but nothing dramatic. I can't remember what the exchange rate was. I think it was par in those days.
We were
given an increased rental allowance, weren't we?
Yes, we did, because we must have got more than we got in Ottawa, because
yes.
I then could afford to have a cleaning woman.
Yes.
Ruth.
Yes.
I remember her well.
Yes. I couldn't tell you how much, but it was considered quite an attractive post.
What did you do in the Pentagon?
Well, I was in a shop known as this was the Directorate of Organizational Planning, really an extension of what I had been doing in Ottawa for the RCF, now doing a similar job for the newly formed United States Air Force. And the United States Air Force at that point in time was restructuring itself organizationally. And they were going to a thing they called their wing base plan that looked remarkably like a similar RCF, RAF structure with which I'd been familiar.
So were you the resident expert then?
I was a resident consultant, if you like, but completely integrated in the staff, doing exclusively United States Air Force business, but using my earlier knowledge of RCF organization and RAF organization as well, in assisting them in setting up this new wing base plan that was still in a proposal stage in 1948, and it really wasn't bought as a USAF organizational concept until sometime in 49. And they've stuck with that wing-based plan with minor modification since that time.
What about the Canadians in Washington? There's a large contingent there. There's the military, that great block up on
Massachusetts. That came,
or
that,
this all comes later.
That gray block on Massachusetts came much later. We were in a we were in the house that the wartime RCF staff had occupied, now known as Canadian Joint Staff, the three services in it. But it was a an old...
The power just went out, and we're on batteries now.
Do you want to try a little playback there to see if we...
Yeah, I listened while you...
We're all right, are we?
Yeah, we're cooking right along, thanks. The thing is that you stay in Washington for approximately how long?
2 years.
So
down
two-year
in
appointment.
Say?
Two-year appointment.
Two-year appointment. One didn't know. It could have been 1 year. It could have been three. But on average, postings in those days seemed to run about a two-year cycle. We came back in August of 1950, back to Ottawa. And before that, I had been told that I was a likely candidate in the Chiefs of Staff Secretariat, and then got a telephone call saying that the Secretary of the Cabinet, Norman Robertson, wanted to interview me to be a military secretary in the Privy Council Secretariat.
Robertson, the external affairs wizard?
Norman Robertson was external at this point in time. This is 1950.
Mm-hmm.
Secretary to the cabinet and secretary of the Privy Council, and later on, of course, became ambassador to Washington. And
yes, of course.
And I think was finally undersecretary of external affairs, and I think died in office. I've forgotten when, but a very impressive man. In any event, back I flew to Ottawa for this.
Take a pause. Okay, the phones are off. We're gonna tie it off right now.
Wrap it up here.
No more interruptions. No power failures, telephones, anything else.
All right.
Now, you were called to see Norman Robertson. I got to hear all about this.
All right. Interview.